When Hosni Mubarak stepped down on February 11th of last year, the protesters in Tahrir Square erupted in cheers that lasted for hours. Since then, the promise of those days has collided with the reality of the country's first free elections, the military's tightening grip on power, and the country's faltering economy. Joining me now to discuss the complex political situation in Egypt today is Ashraf Khalil. His article, The Fading of Tahrir Square, appears in the latest issue of Foreign Affairs. He's also the author of Liberation Square, Inside the Egyptian Revolution and the Rebirth of a Nation, which is published by St. Martin's Press. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show today for today's first backstory segment. Hello. I'm okay. Today, Egyptian state media are reporting that Omar Suleiman, the former head of the country's intelligence service, died in an American hospital. How has that news been received in Egypt?
That's huge. That's going to take a while to see how that ripples through Egypt. He was such an iconic figure and symbol of something so potent that there's a sense of shock. We'll see on the sort of public affairs shows that dominate nightly television in Egypt how that's being handled and how he is eulogized and remembered.
Eulogized even though he represented something rather awful in the previous regime, although he is the man who read the announcement that Mubarak had resigned and transferred power to the military.
He's not, it would be unfair to say he is universally hated or that it is universally accepted that he represents something awful. I think for a lot of people, he represents the stability of a bygone era. I mean, Egypt has, large sections of Egypt are now kind of in the grips of a certain nostalgia for the, if not the stability, then the predictability of the Mubarak era. And that explains why Ahmed Shafiq, who is a Mubarak era prime minister, nearly captured the presidency. So Omar Suleiman, that crowd, the same people who voted for Ahmed Shafiq, would view Omar Suleiman quite likely with a certain amount of sympathy.
And you write in your piece for Foreign Affairs, the emotional and strategic meaning of Tahrir Square has partially faded from its recent glory. So what does the space mean to many Egyptians now?
Well, it's kind of shifting. The recent incarnations of Tahrir Square have been very different than the revolutionary Tahrir Square. They've been much less diverse. They've been more kind of one note ideologically. They've been more Islamist. They've been more male. The sort of effortless mingling of different ideologies, different socioeconomic backgrounds, male and female, that effortless diversity that marked revolutionary Tahrir Square, that's gone. It might come back. I mean, I don't want my article to sound like I'm saying it's dead, but it's at a bit of a low point. I do predict it will come back in a different form, that Tahrir will regain its political and emotional meaning to many of the same revolutionaries who currently are staying away.
Well, you note that now in Tahrir Square, there are almost as many SpongeBob SquarePants T-shirts for sale as there are Egyptian flags.
Yeah, well, that's been like that. The tourist touts showed up, not long, like the final days of the revolution. That it was the tourist touts really showed up. And, the people that are just there to sell things to anyone who's there. And that kind of like slightly grubby street carnival feeling. That's been there, if not at the tail end of the revolution, Tahrir has been like that since last summer. Last July, there was a kind of a second occupation of Tahrir to protest lack of reform, to protest the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, the perceived dragging of their feet on true reform by the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces. And that's when it really changed. It felt different there. And the presence of the guys just selling T-shirts, it affects the way I personally feel about Tahrir Square. It'll never be quite the same.
But there still are protesters in the square, overwhelmingly male and Islamists. Where have most of the liberals, secularists, and women gone?
Well, I think one of the saddest things is that I think a lot of the female activists and a lot of the female protesters are, if not staying away, they're approaching it with much more caution. It's not a welcome place the way it was during the revolution. There have been a string of incidents. And look, sexual harassment is a long-term thing. It was a huge problem during the Mubarak era, but this is not sexual harassment what's going on. These are sort of gang attacks, group sexual assault that have happened. And I've talked to human rights people, and they're saying, yes, this is a spike. This is new territory. We haven't seen this. So that's scaring away a certain number of female participants, the sort of the liberal secular, for lack of a better term, let's call them the non-Islamist revolutionary forces. They have begun to stay away through a combination of factors, whether it's fatigue, whether it's distaste with the Muslim Brotherhood is an element of this. There is a reluctance to rally to the side of what is seen as a fight between the Brotherhood and the military, that we no longer, as we, you know, to quote them, as secular revolutionaries, it's not about us anymore. It's about these two powerful bases fighting each other. So there's a feeling that the fight has been stolen from them, and that Tahrir has been stolen from them. But what you're seeing, if you're asking where they are, I think these people are still there. They're just not in Tahrir. They're in each other's houses. They're in coffee shops. They're in political party headquarters. They're planning the next phase of things. And many of them are taking the street protests in places other than Tahrir. They haven't abandoned street protests necessarily. They have just currently ceded Tahrir to its current tenets.
Well, during the heyday of the earlier protests, sexual harassment and attacks on women also took place, including a CBS reporter, but they were mostly from Mubarak supporters. Now you say it's from the Islamists who expect to take power. Is this intended to scare the women away, do you think, or is it just part of the culture?
Well, okay, let me clarify some points. I do maintain that sexual harassment was unknown, was very, very rare during the revolution. The Laura Logan incident took place on February 11th, the day that Mubarak resigned. And that, to my eyes, having been there for the duration of the revolution, that is when the demographics of Tahrir changed. That is when everybody sort of, like, who had been sitting on the fence, flooded in to join the street party, and the people, the kind of people in Tahrir changed, the attitude there changed. And Laura Logan was just the most egregious example, but I know several women who were heavily groped that night. It all changed on February 11th. Up until then, it was very rare in Tahrir. It was one of the things that made Tahrir very unique. Also, I don't think we can say in any fairness that it's the Islamists that are doing these attacks. There's also an element of just kind of rowdy street youths that are there for the carnival. And I think it's more likely that that's the element. I don't want to put forth the idea that the Islamists are in charge of Tahrir now, and as a result, it's unsafe for women. I don't think that's what's happening here. I think it's kind of just rowdy street kids with nothing better to do getting into this kind of gang mentality.
My guest is Ashraf Khalil, who has written an article called The Fading of Tahrir Square for the latest issue of Foreign Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We're talking about Egypt's political situation today on our backstory segment. Earlier this week, Egyptian protesters pelted Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's motorcade with shoes and tomatoes. Why is there so much hostility among Egyptians toward the Obama administration? Or is this something that is specifically aimed at Mrs. Clinton?
I don't think it's the Obama administration, and I don't think it's Hillary Clinton specifically. I think there is just an enduring distrust of the United States and their intentions. What fueled the specific protests are still a bit of a mystery to me. I'm not sure what she is supposed to have been guilty of, or what is supposed to be the inflammatory issue that whips people up. I think it's just a convenient scapegoat for things. There's always this perception, somewhat exaggerated, that America has its finger in all things and is manipulating all of these. I mean, I remember before the electoral results were released, the presidential results, where the Muslim Brotherhood candidate, Mohamed Morsi, won, I was hearing, you know, very sincere and passionate conspiracy theories that America was in bed with the Muslim Brotherhood. You know, it's like there's always a sinister, conspiratorial, and sometimes very improbable spin to what we think America is up to. And in reality, the reality is probably much more prosaic in that America is not actively sort of conspiring to deliver Egypt to this force or that force, but they're probably on the side of stability, even if that means a non-democratic option. I think that's the worst thing you can say about American foreign policy towards Egypt at the moment. But they're so easy to target as this sort of sinister spider constantly plotting to keep Egypt down.
And the New York Times reports that the protesters in Egypt were holding up signs that said, "Stop U.S. funding of the Muslim Brotherhood," and Clinton is the supreme guide of the Muslim Brotherhood. It seems like people in Cairo are joining with Michelle Bachmann in seeing some kind of a connection between the Obama administration and a pro-Muslim agenda.
It's a leap of logic that I honestly have a hard time following. But things get crazy here. Things are so conspiratorial. And frankly, so much of what's really happening, it's so non-transparent that it fuels this urge to find the most baroque possible conspiracy theory to make it all make sense. And I think that's what's happening here. Egypt has always been a place that loved a good conspiracy theory. So I don't even know if it's gotten any worse after Mubarak so much as just more of the world has gotten a chance to see this little Egyptian social neuroses at work.
The parliament has been at the center of a major power struggle. It was disbanded by the military, then called back into session by the president, then disbanded again by the Supreme Constitutional Court. And today, the administrative court said that it had no jurisdiction to rule on two cases that have been brought about parliament. Is this political tug-of-war crippling the country?
Not yet. But if it doesn't get settled soon, yes, it will begin crippling the country. I mean, it's a really destabilizing concept. You know, if you think about it, what we had here in Egypt was the newly elected executive branch openly challenging the authority of the judicial branch over the fate and future of the legislative branch. I mean, that's a disaster in any country. That's a disaster in a stable and harmonious country, much less one as sort of fragile and fragmented as Egypt is. And I do hope that we get some clarity on this soon, because it is going to become a destabilizing force in the short term. I suspect what's going to happen is that the Brotherhood is going to surrender this fight. And you know, they having ascended to the presidency, having captured the presidency, they're going to not concede the legislature, because they're still going to do very well in new parliamentary elections, but they will get their number cut down. Most people are expecting that a new parliamentary election would produce a cut down to size Brotherhood bloc, but still possibly a majority.
But the judges were appointees of the Mubarak regime, so can't we expect to see a continuing situation of this sort, especially since they are really siding with the military?
Well, that's what we've seen in previous months is a string of decisions that God only knows the truth. I mean, God, you know, but a string of decisions that are being widely perceived as heavily politicized decisions. It's weird. Under Mubarak, the judiciary kind of had a reputation for independence. They weren't really on. There were pockets of independence. You couldn't really trust the higher echelons of the judges in Egypt were quite capable of embarrassing the Mubarak regime, quite capable of overturning Mubarak rulings or politicized criminal cases. And there's a perception that they've come more under the thumb of the security establishment in the past few years, maybe at the end of the Mubarak regime and now what we're seeing. And one of the side effects of this is that the Brotherhood are now talking about, the word they use is Tahir, the purification. They want to see the purification of the judges, which is they're kind of tiptoeing up to saying that Egypt's judges need to be purged. And that's a declaration of war between branches as well. That's a whole other drama that could be coming.
Well, is the judiciary kind of feeling its way through the political landscape right now?
The way it was explained to me by a former judge is that in the final years of the Mubarak regime, there was a rebellion among judges after the 2005 elections, which were monitored by judges and which produced huge gains for the Brotherhood because the judges were there and the government and the regime didn't mess with the ballot boxes. After those elections, there was a revolution. There was a kind of revolt among judges. Several prominent judges went public and said, "I saw this, and I saw this, and I saw this. I saw all of these violations," and they were disciplined. They were sort of purged. So basically, what happened in the final years of the Mubarak administration is a lot of troublemaking judges were disciplined, kicked out, and marginalized. And so one of the ironies is that in the final years, Mubarak actually managed to establish or managed to co-opt and politicize large chunks of the judiciary, and that's what we're seeing now.
Now, last year you wrote an article called Five Worst Case Scenarios for the Egyptian Revolution, in which you said the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces decides that it simply can't trust the Egyptian people to govern their own affairs and that they must continue to hold the reins of power. Is that what has happened in the wake of the presidential election in June?
It depends what happens. The answer to that question largely depends what happens with how much power the president has. In that the Supreme Council, you can say they allowed Morsi to win, and honestly, that's how almost everybody sees it. It's not that Morsi won; it's that he had, regardless of whether he had the numbers, he was allowed to win. So now you have a civilian, an elected civilian president, but the Supreme Council, at the last minute, issued a supplemental constitutional declaration that greatly curbed the powers of that president and established the military as almost a fourth branch of government, and that is something that President Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood are still fighting. I think they've given up on the parliamentary fight. The big fight left is how much power Morsi is going to have and whether or not the military will truly be subject to civilian oversight. And it speaks volumes about how confused things are in modern-day Egypt that Mohamed Morsi has been elected president and he's still negotiating over what kind of powers the president has.
Well, we should assume that the Supreme Council and the Muslim Brotherhood will strike some kind of a power-sharing deal, but could that take a pretty long time?
I think it's happening before our eyes. And I don't think it'll take too much longer. And this kind of brings us back to our earlier point. One of the reasons that the non-Islam revolutionary forces have largely stayed away from Tahrir, with some exceptions, but have partly stayed away from Tahrir, is that there is this perception that the Brotherhood is constantly negotiating with the military and constantly ready to cut a deal. So there's this reluctance, like, why would I answer this call? Why would I come down to participate in a Brotherhood-sponsored rally in Tahrir and fight their fight for them when I know in the end they're just going to cut some backroom deal and sell me out? They're going to cut some deal that I disagree with.
Ashraf Khalil is the author of Liberation Square Inside the Egyptian Revolution and the Rebirth of a Nation, which is published by St. Martin's Press. His article in Foreign Affairs is The Fading of Tahrir Square, and you can find a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for talking with us today on Backstory.
No problem. Thank you.